This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on the show, an important court decision is welcome news for American Indians, and singer-songwriter Reyna Del Cid has shows lined up in Bismarck and Fargo before heading off on a European tour. But first, if you grew up in Chicago and then studied percussion in New York, what would be your next move? Well, for my next guest, the answer is obviously move to a farm in the rural Midwest, start a blog, write a best-selling cookbook, and end up on the Food Network. Molly Ye did just that and joins me now by phone from Grand Forks. Molly, thank you so much for being on the show. We always love to have you on Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your blog is My Name is Ye, and your last name is spelled Y-E-H. The cookbook is called Molly on the Range, and the show, Girl Meets Farm, premieres this Sunday at 10 a.m. Central on the Food Network. Congratulations on the new show.
Thank you.
How did this get in the works? Did the Food Network find you? Did you approach the Food Network?
It was all very gradual. I was out in New York for the launch of Molly on the Range. This was 2 Octobers ago. And my agent told me, kind of casually, that the Food Network would like to meet with me. And I thought, okay, like, that sounds fun. I don't really know what to make of that, but sure, it'll be great. And actually, one of my favorite hummus places in New York is on the first floor of where the Food Network offices are. So that was in my mind. I was like, cool, I'm going to eat hummus after this meeting, and it's going to be awesome. And so we went to this meeting and met with a few of the folks over at Food Network, and they were so nice and really cool. And at one point, we got on the subject of Back to the Future, which for me is always the sign of a good meeting. And then after that, in another very casual conversation with my agent, he said, oh, the Food Network would like to send a production company out to your house to see a few scenes of you cooking, see some shots of you going around town, just to see, you know, more of the area. And I had no idea how official this was, or if this footage would be taken at the pitch meetings, or how this all worked. But I was just like, okay, that sounds fun, cool. And so a production company came out, and we spent a few days making hot dish and cookie salad and going around town. And then a few months later, again, I very casually heard, like, oh, they would like to do a pilot. They came back in December. And then it went to series, and then we shot the rest of the series in April.
And you said you were making hot dish with them. You grew up in Chicago, went to school, you studied percussion at Juilliard, and now you're making hot dish. You definitely have fully embraced the Midwestern, the Minnesota diet.
Yeah. Hot dish is my new favorite thing. I have no idea how I went the first 24 years of my life without having hot dish. And when I moved here, I fell in love with it immediately. It was everything I dreamt of and more. And so there's definitely going to be hot dish on the show. There will definitely be cookie salad. And that's one episode that really showcases the region. And I was really happy about how the production company was so excited about showcasing Grand Forks and food of the farm and of the region, selling my chickens and regional ingredients like walleye. But on the other hand, though, there's also a lot of food that I brought to the farm that's inspired by my Chinese and Jewish heritage. Mm-hmm. So there will be potstickers and scallion pancakes and challah and biscuit, and it's just kind of a melting pot of deliciousness.
It sounds like the best of all of your cultural backgrounds, comfort foods, sort of come together.
Oh, yes. It's a lot of comfort food on this show, yeah.
Oh, I'm very excited to watch it. Can you give a sense of how the episodes are structured, or do you even know what the final episodes look like?
Each episode is built around a menu and an event. So it could be an event as big as my sister-in-law's baby shower, or we had an anniversary brunch. And then sometimes the events are just as casual as oh, my husband's parents are coming over for dinner tonight. They live across the street. So they're going to walk across the street and we're going to eat dinner. And then throughout the show, I cook a full menu, and then there are little shots interspersed of me visiting Nick out on the farm or collecting eggs for my chickens, things that get me outside. And sometimes I go to town to and get dishes for the baby shower, meet up with my friends. So it's mostly in the kitchen, but then there are a lot of fun shots around town and around the farm. Mm.
And do you have pretty good free rein on what an episode is, or is the Food Network, you know, somewhat in charge of saying, well, here's what we need and here's what we would like and here's what, you know, test audiences have said they want to see?
It was such a fun experience creating the menus. It was really collaborative. It wasn't just how I work on my blog, which is, you know, just whatever I'm sort of feeling like in that moment. But this was more about creating a full menu. And but a lot of the dishes were either taken from my blog or inspired by recipes from my blog and taken from my books and such. And so all of the flavors feel very much like flavors that I care about and that I use all the time. And that was the focus. I mean, for me, my biggest priority was making food that is meaningful to me and that tells a story and that I love. And one thing that I feel particularly good about in this process was that the Food Network was fully supportive of that. Hmm. And everybody on the show was really into making food that was special to me. And I mean, there were some points where, you know, we made some different substitutions from the blog that, you know, might be an ingredient that's a little bit more accessible to more people, or made the dish, you know, slightly less time consuming, because I have the tendency on my blog and in my books to make recipes that take an entire weekend.
I've made your khachapuri. It took me all day and I made a big
mess. And there's the overnight dough. Something like that. We would give the option for using a store-bought pizza dough. Okay. And so just like little things that don't really take away from the integrity of a recipe, but that can make it easier for more people to make.
Okay. We're visiting with Molly Ye. She is the food blogger behind the wildly popular blog My Name Is Ye, and that is spelled Y-E-H. And she is the writer of the cookbook Molly on the Range. And she is now the host, the main personality on Girl Meets Farm, which premieres this Sunday at 10 a.m. Central on the Food Network. Molly, how is cooking different for a TV show than it is for writing a blog?
So in the TV show, we cook it. So we film the recipe being shot twice, and it's a really fast-moving schedule. So if I'm making a loaf of bread, for example, I'll stick the dough into the loaf into the oven, and then I'll, you know, kind of turn my back. And then while I have turned my back, a food stylist will switch the loaf into a fully baked loaf, and then I'll open up the oven and be like, oh, that was magic. So there really is like some TV magic at work in the interest of time, in the interest of sticking to a schedule. And so there's a lot of what we call swap outs, which are those dishes that that help us jump ahead steps that might take a while. And there's a culinary team that came to town that set up an entire second kitchen in our garage, and they are working on those swap outs for the whole day, you know, making sure that when we're filming, we can just be moving right along.
Is your blog, do you think, will it change a little? And maybe especially working with a food stylist, you have a beautiful blog already. It's just wonderfully stylized, I would say. But, you know, maybe with working with a professional food stylist, will we maybe see some changes to the blog?
No, I mean, the food stylists, when they come to town, they are working exclusively on the show.
Okay.
And so the shoot was 2.5 weeks in April. And then when they packed up and left, it was back to the blog for me, back to, you know, working by myself, doing recipe development and styling my own photos and working with my photographer, Fargo. And so yeah, no, the blog is still going to be there. I'm still going to be doing it all the time. It is going to have some more content now that the show is starting. I'm going to be posting some behind-the-scenes content. There will be some recipes that were ultimately cut from the TV show lineup. And then there will just be sort of, you know, more things to talk about now that the show is going on, because I just was so fascinated by everything that I was learning that happens behind the scenes and some other things that I want to talk about.
Will it change at all the relationship with the Food Network? Will it change a little bit the structure of the blog? I've noticed some posts that it sounds like you've been able to monetize the blog to some extent. There are sponsored posts, for example, from Bon Maman Jam. Will that change at all now with this new relationship?
No, it'll from the beginning, you know, they were very respectful of my blog, and I mean, my blog is my baby. This is something that that I have nurtured for 9 years now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is just a way for me to be creative and for me to exercise what I'm passionate about. And so from the beginning of talking to the Food Network, they've been so respectful of my creative outlet, my blog, my baby blog, and just allowing me to continue to just be creative on that site. Yeah.
Your husband, Nick, you call him Egg Boy throughout the cookbook, Molly on the Range, because if I remember correctly, he was trying to gain some weight. He was a little self-conscious about being sort of a scrawny Midwesterner and eating a lot of eggs when you guys met. Is Egg Boy going to be on the show a lot?
Yes. Yeah. I think he's in almost every episode, because we've been showing a lot of the farm, and so one of the episodes, I take a farm lunch out to him, and so we eat that in the field. On another episode, he builds a donut display board for my sister-in-law's baby shower. And yeah, so we find some really fun ways to incorporate him, and it was like so much fun.
What are the stages that Molly Yeh goes through when it comes to recipe development, or does it totally depend on whatever recipe you're trying to develop?
Yeah, I mean, it does depend in a sense, but also in general, I mean, the research phase is probably the longest phase. I kind of employ a measure twice, cut once mentality with recipes, because I don't want to get into the kitchen and start cooking a recipe if I'm not feeling good about the fact that this is going to be a success. And so I read as much as I can about a recipe, as much as I can about dishes and techniques employed in that recipe. I'll read about related ingredients, related dishes, the history of a dish, and just as many recipes that I can for it, and just gain a broad understanding of it. And then I'm also at the same time making lists of elements of recipes that I'm particularly drawn to. So a particular flavor that I want to incorporate, or a particular texture that I really want to emphasize. And then I kind of use that as a guide to draft my own recipe. And then once I have that draft, I get in the kitchen and I start testing. And then that's just a matter of testing, tasting, tweaking, making Nick eat it, having my friends eat it, and giving me feedback about that, and then testing it a few more times.
We're visiting with Molly Yeh. Her new show, Girl Meets Farm, premieres this Sunday at 10 a.m. Central on the Food Network. Molly, you have a degree in percussion from Juilliard. Where did you learn your cooking and baking techniques?
I've always been around cooking and baking. My mom is an amazing cook and baker, and I grew up thinking that it was normal for every Sunday morning for there to be a fresh scone or a fresh coffee cake there. And so from an early age, I would bake with my mom. And then when I moved to Grand Forks, I worked at Dakota Harvest for a little while and learned a lot more there. And then aside from that, I read a lot. I practice a lot. I talk to a lot of friends who have worked in kitchens or do work in kitchens, and just try to pull in knowledge from every little place I can find it.
Do you have aspirations of becoming a chef? Would you go back to school?
I want to go back to school. I would love to eventually maybe open up a restaurant or open up a little cafe. I like brunch, and so I would love for there to be more brunch options in Grand Forks.
Brunch is one of my top five favorite meals, so I will definitely support that decision if that opens. Do we know, will there be a second season of Girl Meets Farm?
We will find out after a few of the episodes run. So for everybody listening, next Sunday, put Girl Meets Farm on every single one of your TVs so that we can get those ratings and get approved for a season two.
I noticed there is a hashtag, The Girl Meets Farm. Are you planning on live blogging during the premiere, or how do you keep that conversation going outside
I will be posting all about it on Instagram, possibly on Twitter. I'm actually going to be at my best friend's bachelor party in Amsterdam during the premiere, so I don't know if I'm going to be able to live tweet the premiere, but I'll certainly be posting about it on the blog and on Instagram.
What can Molly Yeh never be without in the kitchen?
Rainbow sprinkles. Of course.
Sprinkles are pretty delicious. That was not the pantry staple. That was a staple I was expecting to hear. Usually there's butter or, you know, something there.
Yeah, I mean, sprinkles. Probably more realistically salt, but I love to have my sprinkles nearby.
Did you have any sort of mentorship or help along the way as you were developing the show? Amy Thielen, she is based just outside of Park Rapids, Minnesota, very similar sort of concept here where she was doing classic Midwestern food for the Food Network for a couple of seasons. Did you have any help developing this show?
You know what, the crew, like every single person on the crew from, you know, the production side and the culinary side, they were my support system. In addition to my husband, I mean, like everybody and my husband's family, like everybody that I'm closest to and the crew, it's just like they've been this incredible support system. The culinary team has sort of helped to prepare me for what to expect. And same thing with the producer and the showrunner. Everybody is just very open about sharing knowledge about what happens after the show airs, or what happens after we film the show, and what happens during the shoot, and all of that. I always felt like very supported and very in the know about this process.
Molly Yeh has a new show on the Food Network. It premieres Sunday at 10 a.m. Central. It's called Girl Meets Farm. She is also the force behind the blog My Name is Yeh, and the spelling on Yeh is Y-E-H, and her cookbook is called Molly on the Range. Molly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up next on Main Street, we're off to a horseradish festival.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives. And by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. From sushi to prime rib, Bloody Marys to cocktail sauce, there's one ingredient that can give them that signature zing: horseradish. Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck went to the International Horseradish Festival near St. Louis to find out more about the pungent root and the people who celebrate it.
Even in the 95-degree heat, horseradish can be hotter.
Woo!
Oh, yeah.
Where's the steak?
That's right.
This is the 31st Annual Horseradish Festival in Collinsville, Illinois. It nearly doubled in size this year and isn't slowing down. Or at least, not if co-organizer Shannon Stelling has anything to say about it.
I'm very passionate about it. I get very excited talking about it.
Most of the nation's, if not the world's, commercial horseradish comes from two counties near this southwestern Illinois town. And it's got roots more than 100 years deep. So Stelling wants to keep it front and center.
Because it's such a rich part of our tradition here in Collinsville.
She's not the only root enthusiast. Thousands of festival goers were buying up horseradish plants, horseradish sauces, horseradish smothered bratwursts, and plenty of horseradish Bloody Marys. Here's Chef Carl Vollmer, who prepared them.
We made 56 gallons of it. Out of the 56 gallons, 8 gallons of it is horseradish.
And then there's the horseradish throwing and blending and plenty of tasting. I tried some blended with just vinegar and salt water. That's got some zing to it.
That's got some zing to it. There you go.
I also ate some in Charlie Adams' gourmet mustard.
That's delicious. That is a mild horseradish.
Yeah.
Those who grow it love it too, but caution that it should be eaten in moderation.
Because otherwise you're going to think it's not good if you overdo it.
That's Dennis Hepke. He and his brother Jeff are fifth-generation horseradish farmers in Madison County, Illinois. They grow about 200 acres of horseradish in different fields every year, cycling back every 5 to 7 years to prevent root rot, insects, and nutrient loss. When they're ready, these roots are massive, often more than a foot long and a couple inches in diameter at the top, much larger than most garden-grown roots. Jeff says that's because here in the Mississippi River bottoms, the roots thrive.
The sandy soil and the mild winters helps with harvest.
Horseradish may seem obscure, but you're probably eating it more than you think. Take the wasabi paste that's served with sushi. Chances are, as Dennis explains, it's probably not from an actual wasabi plant.
A lot of wasabi, quote unquote, is horseradish just dyed green because wasabi is so incredibly expensive and hard to grow.
And what about that zip in your shrimp cocktail sauce? Also horseradish. For those of the Jewish faith, it's often on a Seder dish as a bitter herb. The nation's largest supplier for the root is right in Collinsville. It's called J.R. Kelly Company. They sell up to 12 million pounds a year from area growers to companies around the nation and the world. Some goes to grocers, but most goes to grinders for sauces. Sauces that keep flying off the shelves at this festival, which is way bigger than the 50-person barbecue in an alleyway park where it started in 1987. The festival moved away from the local shopping area for decades, but came back to Main Street this year. And that's no accident, as Collinsville tries to bring in more revenue for area businesses and incentivize people to stay.
The state of Illinois, unfortunately, is shrinking.
Collinsville Mayor John Miller says this right before cutting a ribbon for a new business.
And we're doing everything we can to keep people here.
And people swarmed the festival on its second day. Even as it started to rain and thunder, folks stuck around, hiding briefly under stoops and popping back out the second the rain went away. They had plenty of non-horseradish festivities too, like a novice ventriloquist, a police dog demonstration, and an Elvis impersonator.
Thank you very much. You're fantastic.
But even as people were distracted by this or that, you'd catch the whiff of that zesty root. And it lingers. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative covering food, fuel, and field. Still to come on Main Street, details on a Supreme Court decision and how it impacts fishing rights. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
We've been doing this for 10 years. This agreement, this new one, really sets the stage for the next 10 years.
North Dakota State College of Science President John Richmond and North Dakota State University President Dean Brashani formally signed onto a memorandum of agreement they say will help better meet the educational needs of the state and local area. President Brashani says the two schools have a unique approach. He says by working together, the two schools can provide better service on all levels.
Nothing we look at is siloed. It's how can we collaborate and cooperate better between us.
The two schools have already created the pathway and reverse transfer programs to allow enhanced options for coursework and credit transfers. President Richmond says the new memorandum builds on past accomplishments.
It's an opportunity for us to look for those ways that we can reduce the redundancy, can reduce that duplication, to better serve, again, back to the private sector and to students.
The two officials say the partnership not only helps create a seamless way of providing transfers between NDSU and NDSCS, it also creates a unique niche in providing programs to meet workforce needs. Democratic U.S. House candidate Max Schneider says if elected, he plans to work on preserving health care gains in North Dakota under the Affordable Care Act. He says while there are parts of the health care law that need improvement, the ACA has made great strides to provide health care to people who need it. He says the ACA protects coverage for North Dakotans with pre-existing conditions and that just shy of 20,000 North Dakotans gained access to health care under Medicaid expansion between 2013 and 2016. He also says there was a 54% drop in the state's rate of uninsured residents between 2013 and 2015. He says health care coverage is integral to anyone's quality of life.
Someone suffers a medical emergency because of their health, they can't continue in their jobs. Because they no longer have a job, they don't have employer-sponsored health insurance. Because they don't have health insurance, they can't get access to quality health care. Because they can't get access to care, their condition deteriorates further, and they're unable to re-enter the workforce. That's not the way it's supposed to be done. North Dakota recognized that. Under Medicaid expansion, many of the people, the hardworking North Dakotans that I represent, they're able to get coverage and able to get treated, even when they lose their employer-sponsored health care. And many of them have actually gotten better to the point where they can re-enter the workforce. It is a true success.
Schneider says his Republican opponent Kelly Armstrong, a former state legislator, supports the total repeal of the Affordable Care Act, calling it an unmitigated disaster. So far, Schneider says Armstrong has not yet talked about concrete plans of what to replace the law with. He says that means people could lose coverage in the meantime, and he isn't on board with that.
I fully recognize that the individual insurance market is failing North Dakotans. I would join the bipartisan effort to enact new laws to make insurance more affordable for individuals and small businesses. But when it comes to unmitigated disaster, that phrase is more appropriately applied to taking health insurance away from a group of North Dakotans whose combined population is about the size of Valley City and Jamestown. I'm not willing to go backwards on health care, and neither are the people of North Dakota. I'll leave the ideological crusades of the last decade in the past, keep what works, and extend a hand to Republicans to work in good faith to improve access to quality health care until everybody in this country can see a doctor and afford it.
Schneider is a Grand Forks attorney and former state legislator. And the state fire marshal's office says the cause of a fire that destroyed the municipal bar in Hunter, North Dakota on April 26th will go down as undetermined. City Council member Dustin Moan is a member of the committee that oversees the operations of the community-owned C&I bar on Main Street.
The delay mainly was because we were waiting on the video from the internal cameras, and the state was able to extract that data, and there was nobody moving around in there or anything, nothing suspicious.
A community meeting days after the fire found overwhelming support to rebuild the bar, which has been a part of the small community north of Fargo since 1945. Fundraising and building committees have been formed, but Moan says no timeline is in place for rebuilding right now. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Treaty rights continue to be in the news, not only regarding pipelines in our region, but now a Supreme Court decision has affirmed fishing rights for Native American tribes in Washington state. We learn more from The Takeaway with host Tanzina Vega.
For Native American tribes in Washington state, salmon fishing is a way of life.
For an Indian, you're just not alive unless you're able to fish, to eat fish. Not only for the economics, but for your culture. My tribe so believes in it so much that when we don't have enough for ceremonial purposes, we buy fish and freeze it for the winter time.
That's Lorraine Loomis, chairman of the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission and member of the Swinomish Tribe in Washington. Over the past three decades, Native American tribes in the state have seen their salmon harvest fall by about 75%.
Salmon runs are declining because of habitat. We're losing more habitat than we're able to restore. So that's a problem. We're born on the water, raised on the water, and it's just our life.
But this week, the Swinomish tribe got some good news in the form of a 4-4 split by the Supreme Court. John Eligo is a national correspondent for the New York Times, and he has the story for us. John, welcome.
Thank you.
So that split by the Supreme Court gave the tribe some good news in the form of what exactly?
So essentially what the decision does is it upholds a lower court ruling, which says that the state of Washington has to spend billions of dollars to fix roads that were essentially blocking streams. Now, these streams are important because in order for salmon to spawn, to lay eggs, they have to swim upstream. But when you build some of these roads over streams, they weren't building proper passages known as culverts below them. So what this ruling says is the state now has to fix them by 2030, which the Swinomish hope will then allow salmon to get upstream, spawn, lay eggs, and for that population to then increase.
What are the Stevens Treaties, and what role did they play in this decision?
Well, the Stevens Treaties were some agreements that were come to between the governor of Washington at the time back in 1854 and 1855 and the tribes. And essentially what they said is the tribes said, okay, we'll give you these millions of acres of land. In exchange, we are reserving our right to fish these waters that our ancestors have fished before colonization. So it essentially gave them that right to continue to fish. And what happened over the years is that eventually it got to a point where the state was not necessarily respecting that. So you had this time in the 60s and the 70s, 1960s and 1970s, when it was a period called the Fishing Wars. And essentially you had Native American fishermen going out there and fishing outside of the so-called rules that the state had. And so some of them were getting arrested. Billy Franks was one of the famous advocates and activists, Native American activists on this front. And so that's really what started the court case, was they were saying, hey, we're out here fishing and we are trying to uphold our treaty rights, but you're not respecting that, is what they were saying to the state.
Now, salmon fishing obviously has been impacted by this in recent years. What is the significance for this in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, you know, it's very significant for the tribes in the sense that if you think back, you know, they're the first people here on this continent, and they have been fishing forever. And for a lot of these folks still today, it's not just, you know, hey, let me go fish for fun. It's fishing because that's what they eat. It's fishing because that's what they sell to make money. It's fishing because that is what they do when they get together with their families. And, you know, what the tribes also like to say is that, hey, this ruling doesn't just help us. There's sports fishermen who are not Native Americans who also enjoy fishing and do that, you know. And so it's really become like a way of life for them. And I really got a chance to see that when I went out on a boat with the chairman of the tribe. I was out with him, one of his daughters, and his wife. And this is kind of what they do. This is their family time. This is their bonding time. You know, they bring out chips. They bring out drinks. You know, in some ways, it's for them connecting with their traditions, connecting with who they are. Because this chairman, he went fishing with his father. His father went fishing with his father. And so it goes back many generations.
You don't get a lot of salmon fishing news, but that's what we're talking about right now with John Elligo, national correspondent for The New York Times, about a Supreme Court decision and how it's affecting Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest. John, I'm wondering, this was a split decision by the court. Can you tell us a little bit about why it was split and how the court has been dealing with tribal issues generally?
Yeah, well, this case was split in large part because Justice Anthony Kennedy, he was actually on the Ninth Circuit back when it decided an element of this case in 1984. So this case has been going on since the mid-70s. So it's been a pretty long-running decision. And so in this case, you know, Justice Kennedy had to sit out. And so the court was pretty much split along, you know, liberal ideological lines. And the case is really centered around different issues. And the current issue that came up is when you have these treaties, what is the obligation of the state in honoring those treaties? And what the Native Americans were saying is that the treaties also guarantee a right that we have to have fish to harvest. If there are no fish, then there's no treaty. And so basically what they argued is that what the state was doing is by building road culverts and other development, they were destroying the habitat. And the courts have sided with them saying, you know, yes, there is an implied right in these treaties that say, hey, if you want to respect the treaty, then you cannot destroy the habitat that allows salmon to be in the water. And so that's kind of what was contested over here. And the courts did essentially uphold this ruling that there are these implied rights in treaties. And the one thing I'll say is that Native Americans see this as a very important issue for treaties across the country, because think about when these treaties were created, you know, hundreds of years ago, it could not have foreseen everything that was going to happen. It could not have foreseen the development of cities and things like that. So they're saying, if there are not certain implied rights that don't apply to the letter of the language, then, you know, a lot of the other treaties that we have in other states over other things, they could be found, you know, null and void if this case were not upheld.
And what are you looking towards after this decision? Are there any next steps? Are there any other cases that have caught your eye that sort of connect with this one?
So I think this case is going to keep on going, you know, because one of the things about the split decision is that there was no opinion written by the court. So the court has not necessarily grappled with that underlying issue. The Supreme Court has not had its say on this issue of these implied rights, on the fact that the state has to allow there to be salmon and they can't destroy it. So some legal experts believe that, hey, this is just going to actually head back to court, and this case that started in 1974 will pick up again and form another case. And so it seems like they're not completely in the clear now, but, you know, for now, a lot of Native Americans are very satisfied with this ruling and saying, hey, it's a starting point for us, and we can move forward from here.
John Elligo is a national correspondent for The New York Times. John, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And he was visiting with Tanzina Vega. She is the host of The Takeaway from WNYC. Coming up next on Main Street, singer-songwriter Raina Del Cid.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Raina Del Cid is a singer-songwriter based in Minneapolis, and she was featured during the 2015 season of Prairie Musicians here on Prairie Public. Her band is coming to Bismarck and Fargo for a couple shows this weekend, and then she's off to Europe for most of July. We share a recent interview as Raina visits with Lori Walsh of South Dakota Public Broadcasting's In the Moment.
My dad bought me a guitar when I was about 15 and started taking lessons and writing songs then, but didn't really start performing until around college age, like 18, 19, in the coffee shops around Minneapolis. And then after college, I formed a band, and we've been kind of playing out professionally. We're all full-time musicians now, and we've been doing that for about 5 years. So, but yeah, it started, you know, in my bedroom, basically posting some videos to MySpace back when that was a thing, and yeah, kind of gathering an online fan base at a pretty young age. So I was lucky to have the internet.
Talk about making the transition from, you know, a solo artist or, you know, to the more integrated music. You mentioned Tony earlier. What's it like to sort of open the door to collaboration on a new level? How do you approach that?
I think I really struggled with collaboration in the beginning. I've always saw myself as this solo singer-songwriter and was afraid that if I collaborated with people that somehow the music would change in a way that I didn't want it to or I wouldn't recognize it. But I think in the last few years, you know, collaborating with Tony and then, you know, we've added keyboard player and bass player and drummer, and we've played with so many different people, mandolin, violin, string sections, horns. And the more people I collaborate, I think, with, the more the music takes on a life of its own, and I've really enjoyed, you know, you're still at the helm, you're still kind of making decisions, but people bring things to the table that you never could have imagined before. And I had a friend who currently is a musicologist, getting her PhD, like, and she dabbles in composition, and she helped me arrange a string part for the last album, and the strings, I think, just completely bring those songs to a new level. So that's an example of something where I could never have done that on my own.
Does some of that collaboration happen live, you know, on stage, where you sort of look around and you realize that something's happening that maybe hasn't happened before?
Totally, yeah. And sometimes those things will arise from maybe, like, I went to a section too early or something, and the band will follow me, but then because it's unexpected, things will happen. Like, people, you know, Tony will take an unexpected improvised solo, and those are the moments that I really live for with the live show, with touring, and, you know, that's the sort of thing that doesn't necessarily happen in the studio. And that's why it's nice to have both a blend of studio time and just live.
Yeah. What are the themes that you return to again and again as an artist? Do you find that there are ideas or themes that you could just never exhaust? There's always a new way to look at it.
I think just, you know, for whatever reason, I've always been obsessed with, like, just mental illness, you know, in some way. And I guess that's the thing I've always struggled with in my life, just have problems with anxiety and depression. And that's, for whatever reason, a topic that you can put it in so many different packages and, you know, mask it with different metaphors and you know, sing about it in ways that people might not even realize that's what the song is about. And it never seems to be exhausted. You know, it's just, yeah, it's just one of those themes. And it's also a thing that I don't think maybe is in too many songs already. So,
Right, yeah.
I never, I get a little tired of writing about love and some of the things that you hear on the radio all the time. So,
so does that give you a deeper connection then to some of your fans who might come and there might be a song that reaches them in a way that a song about a romance might not have accomplished?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've heard from a lot of people that that is the case, and that's been rewarding in some way.
What's touring like for you? How do you create something that you really want to do and really want to show up for, so you're not just getting through the tour, you're looking forward to it?
Well, I think, you know, a big part of that has been surrounding yourself with the right people. You know, once you realize, like, these are people that I do actually want to spend a lot of time with, and that has made a huge difference. And also, just staying healthy on the road has been a challenge. Like, a lot of musicians struggle with this, where it's hard to find a healthy meal, you know, every day, and it's hard to get exercise when you're just sitting in the van for hours. And so I've the last couple of years have really made that a priority, where I try to go for runs, and I try to, you know, try to figure out how are we going to have healthy meals on the road, where are the places we can go. And then I think just, you know, having well orchestrated songs that, you know, where we really work hard to make them interesting for ourselves, so that when we are touring on them and playing them, you know, every single night, we don't get sick of them. There's always something for us too, where we're engaged, and seeing the audience reactions kind of feeds us too. So, and it's different in every city, and you never know what you're going to get. And many times these are new places for us. So where people are telling us, you know, where's a good place to get brunch the next day, you know, and you get kind of a personal touch on all these things. So,
Do you write on the road then? Do you generate new material together?
What ends up happening a lot of times is there'll be maybe something that is inspiring, and I'll just end up writing something on the back of a receipt and just saving it for later, you know. So a lot of the writing is just like little fragments or snippets, but I don't really have time on the road to sit down and flesh anything out. There was one tour where I ended up writing a song right before the set, and I just kind of surprised the band and said, hey, I'm going to try this song. It's in the key of D, you know, follow me. And that was actually really cool.
Wow.
Moment, which ended up being a song that we put out as a single called Lover Be Mine. Yeah. And it was kind of cool. So that doesn't happen very often.
And that takes a certain amount of confidence and trust and guts to just say, I'm gonna do this right now. Well, what compelled you to sort of launch it right then? What did you want out of that moment for yourself?
Well, I didn't actually intend to play the song. I'd written it and I was excited about it, but it was really the audience that was you know, that made me want to do that, because it was a really, really amazing, great audience vibe. You know, we had a great connection, and I was like, you know, this is a place that I can totally try this new content out, and the band feels comfortable, I feel comfortable, let's just see what happens. And those are the kind of, like, magic moments that you can't predict, and, you know, and it, sometimes it works out. I guess other times I could see it not working out, but that time it did.
Worth the risk.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
What's next for you? I mean, do you set goals? Do you have, you know, do you plan out a career? Is there a business plan for a musician? How do you sort of move forward and figure out what you want to be doing?
Well, I said to myself when I quit my day job, which was at a publishing company a couple of years ago, and I said that if I reached the age of 30 and I wasn't, like, able to make a living or make the same amount that I was making at my day job, that I would, like, throw in the towel or something as a musician. And luckily, I've gotten to the point right now at 30, it just turned 30, that I reached that goal. But I realized, too, that if I hadn't, I couldn't really do anything else, you know, because I just, this is the thing I actually really want to be doing, and anything else would be, like, throwing my life away, you know. So I don't have any more specific goals for the future, like I need to hit this mile marker. It's more just, you know, how can I live this life sustainably, not destroy my body on tour, still get what I want out of music. And a lot of that is just, you know, surrounding myself with the people that have the same values and the same, you know, drives, and just keep going with it.
It seems like right now, maybe always, I don't know, someone who decides to be an English major, then someone who decides to be a musician, is going to get feedback from well-intentioned loved ones or friends or family who say, you know, maybe you ought to keep that day job, or maybe you ought to study something more practical. Have you had that in your life, or have you really been surrounded by encouragement and people who kind of got you on that level?
I think I was really lucky to have parents that were really supportive. They were going to be proud and supportive no matter what I decided to do. Obviously, you have the relatives at, like, Thanksgiving that say, like, hey, I haven't seen you on Jay Leno yet, so how are things going? You know, there will be those people. But, I mean, I think, you know, I've been really lucky to have that support system, and the people that I'm in this with also, I think, are supported in their lives. So, and we support each other, too. So, I mean, you can't really worry about how other people perceive your life choices. You just kind of have to live your life.
That was Minneapolis-based singer-songwriter Raina Del Cid speaking with Lori Walsh from South Dakota Public Broadcasting's In the Moment. And Raina and her band have performed on our television service on the show Prairie Musicians. So from the 2015 episode, let's listen to a recording of the song, This One's Gonna Hurt.
You say you got my number from a friend. Now you're at my door, just dying to get in. But you don't know the fire from the wood. You can come on in, but I don't think you should.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 18th. On this date in 1914, the Weekly Times Record of Valley City announced on the front page that Miss Catherine Stinson, the aviatress, would be attending the Barnes County Fair. Miss Stinson was one of the first women in the U.S. to earn a pilot certificate. To this day, piloting is a male-dominated profession. Women in Aviation International reported that only 6% of pilots were women as of 2017. However, More and more women enter this career path every year. Among them are the female students at the University of North Dakota's John D. Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences. It was on this date in 2013 that Amy Warbelow, a flight student from UND and her flight supervisor, Katrina Kugler, became the first UND team to compete in the Air Race Classic. The Classic is an all-women's race, offering an opportunity for women of all skill levels and backgrounds to compete. It's a four-day race, covering approximately 2,400 miles, stopping in multiple cities. The Air Race Classic began in 1929, then known as the Women's Air Derby. Races continued annually until World War II. In 1947, the race resumed as the All-Women's Transcontinental Air Race, but it was unofficially known as the Powder Puff Derby. Among the first to compete in the race were flying legends Louise Thaden, Jackie Cochran, and Amelia Earhart. In 1977, it took on the official name it has today and is run as a nonprofit educational organization. In the early years of the race, competitors raced against one another to each destination in the same weather conditions. Today, each plane is given a specific handicap speed according to its flight capabilities. Each team races to beat their own handicap speed with the option to wait for ideal weather. The planes are not actually racing. It's more of a test of flight skills. The Air Race Classic is beneficial to North Dakota teams in particular because its transcontinental span allows the pilots to experience terrain and weather not found in the state. UND's flight school has continued to participate in the Air Race Classic, celebrating airmanship, teamwork, and celebrating an ever-broadening community of women pilots. Today's Dakota Depot is written by Maria Witham. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
The Justice Department's Inspector General and the head of the FBI take questions before Congress about an investigation into possible bias against President Trump.
The clear finding of the report is that there was no impact, none, on either the Clinton investigation and certainly not on the special counsel investigation.
The questions from lawmakers on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, ag producers can face some very serious stressors, especially when commodity prices are low. That increases their vulnerability to anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and sometimes even suicide. We're going to visit with psychologist Michael Roseman, who has a syndicated column about behavioral health that appears in a number of rural publications. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.